Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, hails the recent maritime deal with Israel without normalization as a major victory. Also in the headlines, South Korea reeling from a Halloween stampede that has killed more than 150 people and injured dozens more in Seoul. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iranians continue to mourn the victims of a recent terrorist attack that happened in the southern city of Shiraz. Earlier today in Shiraz, crowds of people gathered in a big procession to bid farewell to six of the victims. A similar event was held in the nearby city of Yasuj, the hometown of two other victims. On Saturday, 2,000 mourners took part in a funeral in the northeastern city of Mashhad. On Wednesday, a gunman went on a rampage in a shrine in Shiraz, killing 13 of the worshippers there, including women and children. More than two dozen people were also wounded. The assailant was injured by security forces and later died of his wounds in the hospital. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. Officials have pledged to bring those responsible to justice. Islamic scholar Muhammad Nasser Birya tells us about the significance of the huge funeral ceremonies in the midst of riots in Iran.
Whoever looks at this huge amount of people, number of people who come to the processions and the funerals of the martyrs. From the first day that these acts started, it shows that the real voice of nation in Iran are these crowds that they come to celebrate their victims, the martyrs. And this is a kind of vote for the Islamic Republic of Iran as well, and the government and the system. So the aim that the managers of these acts, they followed to divide the nation of Iran into two parts and start crashes between them, it is failed. These are pictures that shows the failure of the managers of this movement, although they have planned from before, and we can see the hands of the managers of these movements, how they coordinated everything.
Now, Lebanon President Michel Aoun is stepping down a day before his term comes to an end and amid a stalemate over who will succeed him. The 89-year-old has been in office since 2016. He took over after a two-year vacancy at the presidential palace. The scenario is repeating itself now. Parliament has been unable to agree on his successor during four recent voting sessions. And that's partially rooted in Lebanon's confessional political system, in which representatives of different religious groups are assigned to top positions. The country has also been without a prime minister for more than a month. A presidential vacuum could deepen the political crisis in Lebanon that's already struggling against one of the worst economic meltdowns in the world. Okay, now from Lebanon, let's bring in Maryam Saleh, our correspondent. She is there live for us and knows better than I do here in our Tehran studio what's happening there. Maryam, so there has been no prime minister for more than a month, like I just said in the intro, and also Michel Aoun is stepping down. Four voting sessions held so far, so what's happening to Lebanon next?
Well, Well, that is the main question that everyone is asking. Now, Lebanon is not the first time that we see the scenario in the country. It's not the first time that we have vacancy in the presidential palace. Just before the election of President Michel Aoun, the presidential palace was empty for 2 years. We did not have a president for that long. But the difference was we did not have a caretaker cabinet. Now, what we are looking at right now is that we are facing a caretaker cabinet, which does not have enough authority to take over the authority of the president, which is by constitution, this is what it's supposed to do. So therefore, Lebanon is not only in a political and social and economic crisis, it's also in a constitutional crisis, where even the constitutional does not have answers to the current vacancy. Unless we do see in a few hours, since the president's term ends officially on Monday, we have only hours left for the Lebanese factions to form a cabinet. Now, as you know, the cabinet was resigned automatically right after the parliamentary elections. Miqati has been designated as prime minister for the last 4 months and has not been able to be in terms and see eye to eye with the other factions in order to form a cabinet that would have the authority to take over after the president. The presidential palace leads to a gate where you have crowds of supporters for President Michel Aoun, who used to be leader of the Free Patriotic Movement. They are waiting to welcome him. He will have a speech for the people, because he said before in an interview that he will be leaving the presidency to go back to serving the people that he began serving in Lebanon. And of course, he is considered to be the most popular president to come to the palace in Lebanese history. Before, all the presidents used to be at a time when they were only elected as a result of certain conditions or as a result of certain consensus or dialogue, and even sometimes foreign pressure, or mostly foreign pressure. But it was Michel Aoun who came as a result of the continuous support of many people and the support, of course, of the factions like Hezbollah and his other allies. Now, we were saying about the prime minister, so therefore we have some hours now left to see if the Prime Minister Miqati and President Michel Aoun and Speaker Nabih Berri agree on a cabinet. This would allow them to have a cabinet of full authority that could probably take over the role of president, as long as we don't have a president. And when it comes to electing a president, that is going to take some time, because we heard from Hezbollah Secretary General and the leader of the Free Patriotic Movement saying that there needs to be consensus on a name that is not a controversial name. And so we're waiting to see what happens on.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Maryam Salalai, for us in Lebanon. Let's see what decision will be made finally. Now, the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, says that both Israel and the U.S. were forced to accept the recently signed maritime deal with Lebanon.
It's very difficult politically, very difficult for their morale, it's difficult for the security, for their economy. And this was a humiliating issue for the Israelis, that you have been since 2012, 2013, drilling, and you promised your people, you promised the people of this entity, and now there is a need, a global need or regional need, that you need this, and then you would annul Karish. They did not have that option. They could not have the ability to go to a war. They did not have the ability or the option to stop drilling in Karish, and therefore their only option was to go to indirect talks. Also, the Americans were under pressure as well.
Nasrallah hailed the maritime deal as a historic and major victory for his country. The Hezbollah leader added that the U.S. was under pressure, as the priority for them was the Ukraine war. He cited American officials who said that they cannot tolerate another war in the region. The Hezbollah chief said Americans lobbied to pressure everybody during negotiations, but Lebanese officials stood fast on their stance. Nasrallah added that the maritime agreement has nothing to do with a so-called normalization with the Tel Aviv regime. Israel and Lebanon officials approved an agreement on Thursday laying out their maritime boundaries. The deal allows them to conduct offshore energy explorations in Karish gas fields. Uh, We're joined by anti-war activist Richard Baker in San Francisco a short time ago for his take on the maritime deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime.
Well, I don't think there could have been a deal without the participation and the role of Hezbollah as the what is really the strongest organization in Lebanon. Certainly, you know, given the history of the expulsion of Israeli forces from the south of Lebanon, and in the 2007 war, was really a signal. Those were signals of how strong Hezbollah is and how strong it is relative to other forces in Lebanon, but also how strong it is in relation to Israel. And it's really the only movement that has been able to cause Israel to have to withdraw, to retreat in the way that it has. So I think that without the participation of Hezbollah, in all likelihood, Israel would have just taken what it wanted to, or would have imposed its own borders, regardless of the interests of Lebanon, in the Mediterranean and in relation to the gas fields there.
At least one Israeli settler has been killed and four others were injured in a shooting attack in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, or Hebron. According to Israeli media, a Palestinian was among the four wounded. They claimed that the operation was performed by a Palestinian attacker who was subsequently shot dead by Israeli forces. The Israeli army says it's conducting a sweep of the area for additional suspects. The latest operation comes as the occupied territories have seen a steep rise in shooting operations by Palestinians recently. Now, this is just days before Israel is to hold its fifth general elections in less than 4 years. Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, hailed the Al-Khalil operation. Hazem Ghassan, who is a Hamas spokesman, said that the operation proves that resistance in the West Bank is able to surprise the occupation forces at any place. He added that the resistance bullets are a practical response to the Zionist regime's settlement expansion in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions have held a rally in Gaza to drum up support for Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank amid increasing Israeli aggression and use of lethal force against Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinians rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to express their solidarity with people in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have stepped up their crackdown, carrying out attacks across the occupied territories and the city of Al-Quds in recent weeks. This while more than 130 Palestinians have been killed by regime forces in the West Bank this year alone, amid an increase in armed resistance. Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
As we stand here, we affirm the unity of the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist enemy. Palestinian resistance factions will always stand by our people in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank in the face of Zionist crimes. We will continue our armed resistance until the liberation of Palestine.
While Israeli forces increase their attacks in the occupied West Bank, extremist Jewish settlers have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds under the silent, watchful eye of the international community.
Today we are sending a message of solidarity to our brethren in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. The armed resistance will only increase for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. The Zionist occupation only understands the language of force, and we will continue the fight until martyrdom or freedom.
During the rally, Palestinian resistance groups warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while asserting that armed resistance is the key to freedom.
We are loyal to armed resistance and to the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. We are fighting for a just cause, and nothing will break the resistance against the Zionist enemy. The criminal Zionist enemy has committed crimes against the Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, and it will pay for the crimes.
Palestinians say they want the occupied West Bank to be part of a future independent Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital.
People here vow to utilize all forms of resistance to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Okay, now to Somalia, where we now had an official estimate of the casualties of two car bomb attacks in the capital, Mogadishu. President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed saying at least 100 people have been killed and 300 injured. Having visited the site of the blasts, Mohammed said a number of victims could rise. The Al-Qaeda affiliate terrorist group, Al-Shabaab, has claimed responsibility. The first of the explosions hit the education ministry near a busy junction. The second occurred as ambulances arrived and people were gathering to help the victims. The attack took place at the same place as the Somalia's largest bombing that killed more than 500 people 5 years ago. Al-Shabaab has fought in Somalia for more than a decade. It's seeking to topple the government and establish its own rule. South Korean president declares a period of national mourning after a Halloween crush in the capital Seoul leaves at least 151 people dead. Yoon Suk-yeol says the incident is a tragedy and disaster in the heart of Seoul that should have never happened. 19 foreigners are among the fatalities. They include nationals of Iran, China, and Norway. The toll is expected to rise. Scores of people have also been injured, some of them critically. The stampede took place as South Koreans marked their first Halloween in 3 years after the government lifted mask wearing and social distancing COVID restrictions. Hundreds of revelers packed into an already crowded alley. People at the top of the sloped alley fell over, resulting in the rush. Most of the dead are women in their 20s.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay. But all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s. In an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump, and if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that, today we're taking a look to see what those effects are. We're looking at the fish. We're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and understanding what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine-clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer, an explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedour Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Bedour Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is, because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the International Platform for Munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kmaq, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. we used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bordeaux Lakes. Harry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bordeaux Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bordeaux Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. One million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea.
To ensure that the convention's objects and purposes exclude completely the possibility of the use of chemical weapons is fulfilled.
Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act, because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us?
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea-dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, Salamun Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have an interesting story and I invite you to listen to it. The title of today's story is Dr. Goldsmith. There was once a king, a kind man whose name was Oliver Goldsmith. He wrote many delightful books, some of which you will read when you are older. He had a gentle heart. He was always ready to help others and to share with them anything that he had. He gave away so much to the poor that he was always poor himself. He was sometimes called Dr. Goldsmith, for he had studied to be a physician. One day, a poor woman asked Dr. Goldsmith to go and see her husband, who was sick and could not eat. Goldsmith did so. He found that the family was in great need. The man had not had work for a long time. He was not sick, but in distress. And as for eating, there was no food in the house. "Call at my room this evening," said Goldsmith to the woman, "and I will give you some medicine for your husband." In the evening, the woman called. Goldsmith gave her a little paper box that was very heavy. "Here is the medicine," he said. "Use it faithfully, and I think it will do your husband a great deal of good. But don't open the box until you reach home." What are the directions for taking it?" asked the woman. "You will find them inside of the box," he answered. When the woman reached her home, she sat down by her husband's side and they opened the box. What do you think they found in it? It was full of pieces of money, and on the top were the directions. To be taken as often as necessity requires. Goldsmith had given them all the ready money that he had. Thank you very much. Really, that was very interesting story. And we'll listen to the points of this story and the continuation of Lantern. Be with us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Lantern, our topic of discussion that is sadaqah or alms, what is known generally as alms. The case that we can talk about the eligibility of giving alms is in the cause of Allah, that is, in the way to spread Islam. The next one is to the wayfarer, Ibn al-Sabil, that is, a traveler or travelers who do not have enough money to go back home. Now, it comes to say that how we can give and pay these alms. God has forbidden giving the alms in some ways. The first way that has been introduced as a forbidden way is giving it out of pretensionness. Such alms is invalid. Or giving alms, or giving the alms followed by reproaching the person to whom it is given, or telling them that one is generous. Such alms also will not be rewarded by God. So we have to be careful not to give our alms out of pretensionness, and we should not reproach the other party that we are going to give the alms to. These are two sorts of alms that are invalid because they are not given for the sake of God, and if they were given for the sake of God, one's intention failed to remain purely for God. On the other hand, there are two ways of giving alms that are praised and adorned by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The first one is what we call it secret alms. If one gives the alms secretly, then he or she will be immune to pretensionness, and the needy person will not feel humiliated, since Islam always emphasizes pure intention for God and action that is more purely done for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, more virtuous. This is why God preferred secret alms to an enclosed one. We have it in chapter 2, verse 271. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, if you conceal the alms, that is best for you. The next type of the alms which has been praised in Al-Quran and the narrations is disclosed alms. You might say that, oh, you have been talking about the secret alms, now you mention disclosed alms. Yes, this is praised because it is a public encouragement of others to give alms, as it is a relief for the poor and the needy in that they see that there are people in the community who are thoughtful about their conditions. It helps them overcome their despair. So how much should we actually give? How much should we give or pay as alms? The amount of alms actually depends on the person himself. One should be moderate in the amount of alms. Or on the other hand, one should not be mean, and on the other hand, one should not give too much so that he or she falls into financial trouble. The minimal amount of alms depends on one's financial ability. According to some hadith and narrations, even a cup of water counts as alms. The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates immoral aspects of our life.
So, let's talk about there are two short topics that are left about the alms to be talked about. That is, blessings that usually follows after giving alms. It's very interesting to be known. There are many hadith concerning the virtues and blessings followed by alms, including being immune to catastrophes and terrible kinds of death. Imam Baqir alayhi salam said that sadaqah protects one from 70 sorts of catastrophes as well as terrible deaths. For a person who gives alms will never undergo a terrible death. Longevity is the next blessing of paying and giving alms. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam said, sadaqah and family ties, silatul rahim, live in our cities and bring longevity. The next blessing of giving alms is healing the sick, according to a hadith. Heal your sick relatives by giving sadaqah. The next one is removing poverty. When you actually give alms, you are removing the poverty from your own family and relatives. The next point that I think it is worth to be talking about is the spiritual effects of sadaqah or giving alms. According to Al-Quran, the holy book of Allah says that giving alms for the sake of God is a beneficial transaction with God, since many divine rewards are given to people who give alms. It guarantees their going to the heaven, protects them from the fears of the doomsday, and saves them from divine tortures. Actually, it removes bad luck. You see, when you are, these are the spiritual benefits of giving alms. We talked about the blessings. Most of those blessings were, some material actually blessings. But when you see that bad luck is removed from you, it means that the doors and gates of blessing of Allah will be opened to you. According to a hadith from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it says, whenever you go through a night to the morning, give alms to remove the bad lucks of that day from you. And whenever you go through a day to the night, give alms to remove the bad luck of that night from you. The next actually spiritual effect of giving sadaqah is helping to cross the Sirat bridge. This has been mentioned in a hadith or narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says that I sought the way to cross the Sirat bridge and I found it in alms. The next spiritual benefit of giving alms is a guarantee for the heaven. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, I guarantee the heaven for six classes of people. A man who puts aside some alms, but he dies, this man goes to the heaven. The other classes that Imam referred to are a person who visits a patient and who goes to the holy war, that is jihad, or a person who practices Hajj rituals, or a person who goes to the Friday prayer, and a person who goes to a funeral. If they die and never return home, then they will be guaranteed to go to the heaven. Many thanks, dear brothers and sisters, for staying tuned and listening to this show of Lantern. I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lebanon's President Michel Aoun leaves the presidential palace at the end of his term amid continued uncertainty over his successor.